this talk has to begin on a note of several ironies. First of all, I was going to do it on my laptop, but I just somehow lost energy for that. Why should I be satisfied with my laptop? It's not a quantum computer, after all. I'll hold out for that. Mike asked me to give a talk here, and I said, well, I'm not sure what to say. I haven't done anything new. I talked last year at Santa Barbara, and I was pretty serious about that, but he insisted that if I don't have any, if I want to talk about anything new, I should talk about something old. Okay, well, all right. So part of my talk is going to be a sheer review of some material that's common to fault tolerance theory at this conference and also other areas of mathematics. And part of it was a result that came out of a discussion that I had with Alexei that we never quite published. And one reason was I was just learning about Alexei's work at the time, and I wasn't quite sure if I had found anything that he hadn't found. But in any case, we had a discussion, and we had some of the same ideas at the same time. Well, it turns out that Mike's invitation was a bit of a trap in a way, because even that isn't new either. Alexei informs me, I didn't know this, that equivalent or even identical results were found by Levin and Wendt recently, and it may be that may be the subject of another talk late this week, as far as I know. So this is even less new than I thought. Well, all right, this will be my version of it. I can start with the general point about there's sort of a dichotomy that was set up yesterday or the day before, I don't quite remember, like this, where Mike has been touting topological phases. John Preskill was emphasizing software fault tolerance. Okay. Now, part of the point is that this picture is not true. The truth of the matter is that both notions are not, they're not written, the boundaries of both sets of ideas are not rigorous to begin with, and they also have a lot of intersection. Here's Mike's domain, and here's John's, and then somewhere in the fuzzy middle, you can use lattice models for both purposes. And in fact, the main result that which is that if you have any consistent system of anions, then it exists as a lattice model, is in this middle ground, because it could be some approximation to some material that really exists, or it could be something that you do in software, or it could be anything in between. And there is a continuum of things between software and chemistry already in material science, or already in physics experiments, or at least between software and material science. And for instance, there are physical experiments on Josephson arrays, which are a pattern material that acts as something in between a physical substance and an integrated circuit. It's really done as an integrated circuit, but you treat it as a physical material. I not only don't want to choose sides, I want to deny that they're separate sides, basically. Okay. So now let me talk about the review part of this. Let me discuss what anions are possible. You can have something like anions. You can have something similar in 1+1 dimensions that is actually widely considered. That is, you can talk about abstract particle statistics in 1+1 dimensions. I'm not sure if they I was calling them anions in my notes, but then it occurred to me that maybe they should be called noons. Because the whole point is that in 1+1 dimensions, the particles can't cross.
Well, they're the pata fermions that have the same structure.
What?
The pata fermions have the same, the same monomer.
Para fermions. Well, para business, that's a separate matter. In fact, in greater than or equals to 4 total dimensions, or 3 dimensions, you actually do have a little bit more, since you mentioned it.
Yeah, I meant in a different sense, in the sense of the para fermionic CFTs.
It's
more
like
anions in that sense.
Okay.
And it's in 1D, it's 1 per 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So this is the chart of what you can have. Okay. So there's a reason that parastatistics were very popular for a while, and they're still very important for understanding the previous two lines. But there's a reason that they're not popular anymore.
What is parastatistics?
Well, this is. Let me just say what the point is. When you have anions, you have braid groups representation. And when you have parastatistics, you have symmetric group representations. So this is an idea that people had before they thought about braid groups. And there's the famous cases of representations of the symmetric group, the statistical sector of a bag of particles could be a one-dimensional representation of the symmetric group. In which case, it's the trivial representation in their bosons, or it's the alternating sine representation in their fermions. But who said that it had to be one-dimensional? You can consider consistent families of representations that have dimension more than one. Why not? It would be non-abelian, quote, non-abelian particles in higher dimensions. Right. This is a necessary idea here, and it's an idea at this level that looked interesting for a while, but turned out not to be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. In fact, this is a little bit out of order, but that's fine. But I'll just mention the theorem. So, theorem. Okay. Any category for parastatistics. Equivalent to bosons plus maybe fermions. Of course, you can't have fermions by themselves. If bosons exist, then maybe fermions don't exist. But if fermions exist, then bosons exist. Okay. Plus internal state. With a symmetry group. Okay.
Would it mean that the fermions cannot exist without bosons?
Well, because if you have two fermions, there are bosons.
Ah.
So fermions alone are not a complete category. They're not a complete algebraic model of particle statistics. Bosons could exist by themselves. Okay.
So what do you mean that?
Well, I'll give you an example. Okay, the technical theorem is with reasonable conditions with a compact symmetry group.
Right. Color activity is an
example.
Color is an example, but they're not the first example that you learned. Okay. Traditional particle spin. Where the group here G, the group is S. particle has is of some species that it's been J for some integer or half integer. And that is in fact an example of parastatistics. It's a slightly broken example of parastatistics because you can have an environment that breaks the symmetry. But in many cases you consider processes, you consider worlds where everything respects the rotational symmetry. So you sometimes have purely SU2 invariant measurements in evolution. And if you're considering a physical system like that, then it's going to be a perfectly valid example of parastatistics. Okay? But it's one that you can describe in another way. What's the other description? You instead attach an internal Hilbert space to each particle and then say, oh, well, there are only bosons and fermions after all. So the parastatistics theorem says that you can't get anything new in that respect.
But what's the multidimensional symmetric group representation that's being fitted in this case?
So, e.g., the representation depends on the parastatistic, on what I can call the parastatistical type or the spin types of the particles. Okay. So, if you have v1/2, so this is a spin qubit. And if you have 2n particles of spin 1/2, then the total Hilbert space has an invariant subspace, okay? And this is the
invariant under SU2.
Yeah, invariant under SU2. Okay, is the parastatistical space of 2n spin 1/2 particles. Okay? And sure enough, there is an action of the symmetric group. It's because you can permute the particles and it's still total spin 0. Okay? And the dimension of this one is a Catalan number. And in this example, no one said that the representation of the symmetric group has to be irreducible. In many cases, it will not be. But in this example, it is. This is a certain Catalan dimensional irreducible representation of the symmetric group. Of course, this is not just the symmetric group. You have the same problem as with braids. You can only freely braid things when all the particles are of the same species. If they have different species, then you should instead discuss the pure braid group. So in general, you'll have a product of symmetric groups if the particles are of different species. Right. Well, the theorem has an interesting history. The mathematician's answer is to your question is yes. There was an earlier theorem, the Tanaka-Crine theorem, which was a weaker result than what the physicists really had in mind when they said, okay, there's the parastatistics theorem. Because in the Tanaka-Crine theorem, you assume that the Hilbert space is free for the individual particles exist. And then Tanaka and Crine showed that the group exists. Okay. But of course, the real theorem you want is the theorem that the Hilbert spaces for the particles exist and the group exists. That's a harder result, and that is the Doppler-Roberts result. Nonetheless, the physicists were content. They were convinced, once they had the Tanaka-Crein theorem, and they still call it, a lot of people still call it the Tanaka-Crein theorem.
Didn't Deligne prove that
also? Deligne proved, so this is in the analytic, the relevant analytic category, where you have Hilbert spaces with a Hermitian structure and compact groups. There's a very similar theorem due to Deligne in the category, in the context of number theory and algebraic geometry. And to further add to the confusion, when the algebraic geometers prove any such theorem, even if it has the full, the strength of the Doppler-Roberts theorem, they call them all Tanakian theorems.
I'm not really coming here related to the color. So actually, parasitism was proposed for quarks, I think, in the middle 60s.
Yes, this is also something I learned. This was proposed. The interest in this was as a model of quarks. And color is another example, one where you really never do see inside the internal Hilbert. I mean, it really is very difficult to see the internal Hilbert spaces.
The theorem was realized by two Japanese physicists, mathematic physicists, I think in the early 70s.
I don't want to dwell forever on the history of this, partly because I don't know it. I don't know all of the details, but I know this much, that it was interesting in
the outcome of this is usually not in three dimensions, it's not in parastatistics.
Well, the point is it's misstated. It's not that there's nothing, it's that there's nothing new.
Right.
This is an important warm-up for understanding anions and noons. Okay. Now there's another result that this is very, so the anions are very different from parastatistics because the Doppler-Roberts, this representability theorem is really false. It's very false in various kinds of, it's false to different degrees, but in some examples it's simply completely false. For instance,
for this complex group or quantum group in some way?
Well, let me discuss that point. Okay. How this is false for anions. Okay. The first way that it's false is that sometimes the group goes to our quantum group of Hopf algebra. Okay. That's fine. That's not totally false. Okay. The second way that things may be falsified is that the internal Hilbert spaces do not exist. Okay. E.g., in the Fibonacci category, the dimension of the Fibonacci object is the golden ratio, which does not exist as a Hilbert space because this isn't an integer.
And it is a subfactor.
Well, that's okay. Okay, if you try hard enough, you can make the Doppler-Roberts point of view impregnable by making all the Hilbert spaces infinite dimensional and having a generalized dimension which doesn't have to be an integer.
Right. But that's what they do.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. So that's it's false or it has to be true, no matter what. But there's something not quite reasonable because the Fibonacci category is a completely finite structure. If you resort to an infinite dimensional model for it to cope with the fact that you have fractional dimensional Hilbert spaces, then you're sort of escaping the technicality in a way. But okay, I'm not. not giving enough respect to the operator algebra's point of view. Yes, you can make infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces for everything and make it true that way. You make it true by construction instead of by derivation. All right. So, from the point of category theory, it's easiest to start with noons, because the definitions of anionic, as a type of anionic statistics, gets unwieldy. But at the very beginning, for the simplest kinds of noons, it's really pretty simple. This is officially by officially I mean rigorously at least a monoidal category. Well, if it's going to be relevant to quantum mechanics, it will be a unitary monoidal category. Okay. So you have abstract particle species. You have a set of abstract particle species A, B, C. Okay, and this will be represented mathematically by category, which you should think of as a kind of graph where the objects are the vertices, and then there is a multiplication law on the objects. This is what you have. This represents compound particles. Okay, and then there's also an addition law on the objects, which represents superpositions. Okay. For instance, in this case of spin statistics, in the case of traditional spin, a particle, you may not have measured whether a particle is spin 0 or spin 1, and then it could be a superposition of those, and then it's then the correct object to give it is in category theory, quadratic language, the direct sum. So the objects form a ring, okay, and then these objects may or may not be represented or representable as explicit Hilbert spaces. That ties up with the representability theorem that I've already been talking about. But then you have, I can just write COM AB, because A and B could be very complicated compound particles or superpositions. A could be a bag of a whole bunch of particles, and so it could be BB. And then you have these two objects. These are both, this one is a Hilbert space of topological states. And this is then the allowed transitions between this species and this species, which and both of them could be compound. Okay. So this isn't the full definition either quite. So you just have to take my word for it that the definition is not so complicated, because I don't have time to get the whole thing. So, since this is a category, you can compose transitions, and there are other such relations. And the reason it's called IND is because of the representability business for Doppler or Roberts. If the group exists, then the object A is a bigger Hilbert space, the total internal Hilbert space, and then you're only allowed to see the invariant part in invariant experiments. Okay. So
why is it called invariant? There's no group around.
I'm saying it's called that if there were one.
By analogy.
Right. So there are other interesting features of the story that I'm doing it. But just take my word for it, it's not all that complicated. But since we're in 1+1 dimensions, the particles can't cross. There's just a library of allowed interactions. And so the category shows you the statistical sector of allowed interactions, so that the category is a way of calculating with directed planar graphs, graphs that, with what I've said so far, are not allowed to turn around. So the category C is the statistical sector of evolutions like this. Of course, there may be other. There may also be a dynamical sector because these particles may have momentum or whatever.
So you're thinking here is like time, the time direction.
That's right. That's right. That's right. In a naked monoidal category, you don't have any time reversibility. You only go forward in time. And for instance, there don't have to be antiparticles. Okay. Now there are various intermediate forms of noons where you introduce antiparticles and properties of them piecemeal. And in among the category theorists, there's a variety of names for these intermediates. But I want to get to the end point. Okay. So noons are at most a spherical category, which the point of the word spherical is to give you antiparticles with full properties. So if a graph is drawn in the plane, then in particular it's also drawn in the sphere, because this plane is contained in the sphere. And no one said that two graphs can be different in the plane but the same in the sphere, because the point at infinity could be moved through, because you can pass through the point at infinity. And the idea that the statistical sector would change if you pass through the point at infinity ends up being a bit pathological. So if you assume as an axiom that it doesn't, so that you have a well-defined calculus of the statistical sector for any graph drawn in the sphere. Okay? So graphs on a sphere. That's the gist of the axioms of the spherical category. But if you're drawing on a sphere instead of drawing from left to right as time goes forward, then in particular antiparticles have to exist, because by the usual argument that something traveling backwards in time is an antiparticle.
Okay. In the unitary case, it's not assumed that antiparticles exist. And
well,
the spherical structure follows automatically.
Okay, so this is something that was mentioned, that I was going to mention, was mentioned to me by Tobias Hagi. This is a theorem that if you have a category where antiparticles exist in the sense that it's a pivotal category, then it's automatically spherical.
No, it's even automatically pivotal in the unitary case.
Well,
so it's true for the unitary. I thought I had an argument.
Well, all right, there is some such theorem. But what I don't know is it may assume that there are only finitely many simple types. this is.
No.
Oh, it doesn't assume.
It doesn't.
Okay. Okay. Well, in the unitary case, the spherical condition maybe maybe not.
As far as I know, these finitely many types are necessary to reason about functors.
Well, all right, I'll get to okay. So, all right, so that's 1 plus 1 dimensions. Now, as far as what behavior is allowed for particles, 1 plus 1 dimension, n dimensions can be taken can be viewed as a special case of n plus 1 dimensions. The extra dimensions could exist. And so in so anions are the same as noons plus greater. Okay. Which then satisfies its own set sets of axioms. And so if you add a grading if you add grading transition. Half-twist transition, then the spherical category is promoted to what's known as a ribbon category. You might call it a link category or something like that. But no, it's called ribbon for a reason. It's because you have to have a theory of rotation. If you do not have it for individual particles. Have it for compound particles because they grade each other. Okay. So you do not have a consistent statistical structure without considering twisting of the particles. And okay, to complete my review, to mostly complete my review, and if your category. It's finite. This means that there are finitely many irreducible statistical species. Okay. And is non-singular in a certain way. Then the ribbon structure gives you what's called a modular category. Which is known to give you three manifold invariants. That's in the theory of topological invariants, but in any case, it gives you invariants of three manifolds, and it's sort of roughly equal. It's certainly equal in special cases, but not somewhat metaphoric, but you can call any of these three manifolds Chern-Simons. It's not literally true, but literally speaking, the invariants from Chern-Simons quantum field theory only give you some special cases. Okay, so I'll be literal minded. This construction that includes Chern-Simons quantum field theory. Okay. Now, the thing that I would like to emphasize.
Excuse me. So Moore and Zeiber have made some conjectures that, which are probably not going to state precisely, but all modular categories come from Chern-Simons.
Well, I don't know what they mean by come from, and that could be negotiable, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but at any literal level, I think that it's simply not true, because there certainly are modular categories that do not equal. Chern-Simons theory for any Lie group for any level.
We're including things like coset constructions and orbifolds and all those things.
Oh, see, I told you, come from is negotiable.
There are some that appear in subvector theory which are not known to come from any of these coset
types. Yeah, but I have the feeling that there are counterexamples.
Would you consider the digraph written by a group of theorists?
No, those are not. Those are okay as Chern-Simons because that really is Chern-Simons with a finite gauge group.
Well, essentially, there's no Chern-Simons for, or there doesn't have to be.
Well, the Chern-Simons business can be rewritten to include these finite groups, and that's what Digraph and Witten had in mind all along.
Okay.
So those are not counterexamples. But the operator Algebraeus, as Dietmar Bisch is saying, have found things that look a lot more like counterexamples, and I'm going to conjecture that that's correct, that conjecture is just wrong. But I can't do that with any authority, since I don't know all of these coset constructions.
I think Greg always used to say the case that he didn't have the coset construction for was the monster group.
Well, there's some simpler candidates than that. There's so I'll just summarize the statement. I think the conclusion is strict. And I was just looking up the paper when I was preparing for this talk. There is a paper by Asa Ada and Hagerup, which gives an exotic example of a spherical category, a unitary spherical category. And I suspect it's sufficiently exotic to address your question. Okay.
The relevant quantum dimension in that context is 5 plus 2, 13 or 2.
Right.
I don't know, is that the number that brings it out?
What's the number? Again?
I don't remember the number, but you just type in the authors. Oh, he gave the number.
not an archive number, a quantum dimension.
Oh, the quantum dimension. That I actually remember. The smallest irreducible has quantum dimension this in one of the two Hagerup examples. Okay.
The other one is 5 plus 17.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. arise as quantum dimension. Now, this example is on the theme of what I was about to say. They make exotic finite spherical categories. So that means finitely many reducible types.
Are they just spherical or modular? Graded.
They don't discuss any possible grading.
They're not graded, but you can double that to a one.
Well, that's what I was going to say. So this is the great connection between noons and anyons. If you have a world of noons with finitely many simple types, with finitely many irreducible types, C is spherical, and there are finitely many irreducibles, then there exists a larger category, D of C, the double, which is in many ways the square of C, a kind of twisted square of C, which is modular. So if C could already be modular, you're always allowed to forget that part of the structure and treat it as noon statistics. Okay. If C is modular, then the double is two copies of C which are complex conjugate. So two copies of C where the phases are all conjugated or the gradings are all backwards.
Is it always modular, or is it merely where
I think it's always. Good question. But I think it's always modular. Okay.
That's me.
Yeah. I believe it's always modular. Okay.
So in particular, that means the S matrix of the principal double is the tensor squared.
tensor square this way,
yeah.
You it's S matrix tensor, the conjugate of the S matrix.
Yes.
So if you're a the theme of this, if you're a field theory aficionado, is that there are two conformal field theories with canceling central charge. The double, by the way it's made, cannot have, has to have vanishing central charge. All the doubles do. So a way to prove this is with the Theorem of Verrone here. Okay. So the Theorem of Verrone invariant looks like this. You have your spherical category, and you take specifically a tetrahedron. Which then must be labeled by six species, and we'll say that they're irreducible species. So there's a six group. So this is a scalar valued tetrahedron symbol. Okay? And it's not quite exactly the same, but up to normalization it's the same as the famous 6J symbol. I mean, it's not numerically equal, but it's the same information as the 6J symbol, or the generalized 6J symbol. In the case of traditional particle spin, it's equivalent information to the famous Biedenhorn-Elliott the famous Rakow-Wigner 6J symbol. Okay. I said scalar value, but it depends on this. It depends on these six species. So they should be irreducible in the way that you use this fellow. Okay? And but it's in a sense it's a tensor because it takes values in the tensor product of the four invariant spaces for these four points of interaction. Okay. So you have in F tensor D tensor A, etc. So really the tetrahedron symbol is a tetralinear form on the product of four of these four invariant spaces. That's even after you choose the six J's, the six quote J's, the six species types. Okay. So then you take the dual tetrahedron and that's just really a notational change. We just, instead of drawing the tetrahedron Feynman diagram like, we draw it in such a way that the six labels are drawn on dual edges so that the invariant factors are associated to the faces instead of the vertices. Okay. This tetrahedron symbol, by the way, has all of the algebraic content of the spherical category. You could write it that way instead. And then the main axiom that this tetrahedron symbol would satisfy in order to have a spherical category is the famous Biedenhorn-Elliott identity, which you learn as an identity that the old 6J symbol satisfies. Okay. So if your notation for the 6J symbol is the dual tetrahedron, then the most important equation that it satisfies is that if you choose nine labels, then the value of the symbol is equal to a certain sum where you sum over the value of a tenth label. Okay, so this is the Biedenhorn-Elliott identity, which you can take as the main axiom for having a spherical category. It's also the main necessary move for understanding
to glue two tetrahedron together there and subdivide it into three? Is that the point?
Yeah, that's right. So there are two tetrahedra here and three tetrahedra here. Okay. And this sum of values is equal to the value on the left, where you have to, where when two tetrahedra are glued along a face, you have to contract the two tensors, the two invariant spaces, which are dual vector spaces. Okay. So then the Theray of Giroux invariant is just the partition function where you use the tetrahedron symbol as the Boltzmann matrix of an interaction. There is a theorem that two triangulations of a three-manifold represent the same three-manifold if and only if they differ by certain moves. The main one is this is a move, the 2-3 move, that matches the Beeton-Parnelius relation. So there's a backwards construction from this kind of, so then that's the theorem, that this partition function is invariant, and is a topological invariant.
So this is if it throws beta symbols and one.
Oh, right, yeah. So plus other normalization. So there are some other Boltzmann weights, the quantum dimensions of the labels, and you have to choose the pairing between the invariant spaces correctly. And that's your theta symbol business. Okay. So this is a 3D state model. This kind of 3D topological invariant can be decoded backwards to produce the modular category that is the double. Now, the thing that Alexei and I were discussing is that...
Don't you need to use the modular Shedekin for invariant
other than... Yeah, that's what you... That's right. That when I say go backwards from the three-manifold invariant, you have to use another construction of invariance, the Resch-Tikhon-Tureyev, in a backwards form to make a category which turns out to be the double.
Or a category if the double turns out to be this one.
Right. No, you start with a spherical category, you make the Tureyev your own invariant, that equal, you recognize that as the Resch-Tikhon-Tureyev invariant of D of C. So you make the double. So now you can also use the Theray-Giroux business in 2 plus 1 dimensions. For two purposes. One is, given a triangulated surface, sigma. Well, if I say 2 plus 1 dimensions, then that means that you're given a triangulated surface. Okay. Then you should do the following to get a physical or logical system where you can have a 2 plus 1 dimensional evolution. You should assign Q-disks to the edges and faces. The Q-disks that you assign to the edges are the label. then the qubits that you assign to the faces are the invariant spaces. Okay? Actually, this is common in both. So you start with that, and you can use the same Terray-Verreau algebra to get certain Hermitian and unitary evolutions. So first I'll describe the Hermitian one. One, you can make projections, you can make local projections. Where you have a piece of the surface that, in my notes, I was calling these vertex projections. You make vertex projections. And then you stick a version of the tetrahedron symbol with a little bit different normalization, where you make a lantern of the, of, you make a bipyramid out of the tetrahedron symbol and change the normalization sum. And that turns out to be a project, that turns out to be a Hermitian projection. So you add a bipyramid. Okay. Which is a Hermitian projection.
Did the triangulation on top and bottom are the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's a bipyramid.
Okay. This trick I can't see well from there.
Okay. And so then, yeah, I drew it terribly too.
Well, it's okay, but I heard the words.
So it doesn't matter how well you can see it. I drew it so badly that it's a good question. Okay. So then the Terray-Verreau invariance implies that it's a projection. And it also implies that they commute. In other words, if you have two adjacent vertices and you stick the bipyramid on from the first vertex and then for the second vertex, you get the same little three-dimensional blister topologically as if you put them on in the other order. So the operators commute. Okay. And so then there's a theorem or corollary. Since they all commute, they have a common space. The common space of the projectors, of the vertex projectors, is a topologically intrinsic Hilbert space, which is the Hilbert space associated to the surface cross an interval. Okay, which is the topological sector, the topological Hilbert space of the spherical category C or the modular category D of C.
So, Craig, just to check, the reason you were justified in saying the word Hermitian is because somewhere earlier you inserted unitary? Is it unitary?
The category is unitary.
Okay.
So then these projectors are Hermitian.
Excuse me, in your model we have fusion spaces on the triangles,
mm-hmm.
right? Because other people may be used to a different notation, but fusion spaces are associated.
This is at an oblique angle, but I sort of drew an incomplete picture of what's going on here.
Uh-huh. Right.
Have a quantum digit for each triangle, which takes values in the invariant space.
Right.
Now that's a little bit unstable because the invariant space may depend on the labels, but you take a big enough Hilbert space to contain all of them.
I think Alexei's just saying that most people see it in the dual picture.
A picture.
The letter Y is more familiar.
Oh, that's fine.
What you mean is that you project on the singlet.
Both notations have been used.
So what you mean is that you project onto the singlet state?
This version of the pictures is more convenient for the tetrahedra in three dimensions.
The other thing would be a prism. right? You can draw those.
Yeah, that's right. It would be a prism instead of a bicarion.
Yeah.
This is just playing with Poincaré duality, with geometric duality.
Okay.
I'm using Schreyer-Barrow's conventions where they dualize like this. But yes, I mean, the string, the dual would be more consistent with the string networks. But I said at one step, let's dualize. I said that before. And so then the other thing that you can do is you can re-triangulate. If you attach a single tetrahedron symbol with normalization to make it more like a 6G symbol, you can go from this to this. So this gives you isomorphisms between. This gives you an isomorphism between the two Hilbert spaces here and here, which are technically defined differently because of the Hilbert space, because the triangulations are different. Okay. So, if I may bend the time a little bit, because there were a lot of questions, I can just wrap up some of the main features of the proposal. So with enough retriangulation, you can get the mapping class group action on sigma. In other words, if you imagine sigma as a fixed surface, then you keep changing the triangulation by flipping diagonals, and you twist it more and more. And eventually, you may have a combinatorially equivalent triangulation that's sitting on the surface in a different position. And then, at least if you've done all of this in software, and if you've emulated it all in a quantum computer, you can say, oh, well, we're back to where we started. And you get a self-isomorphism of this Hilbert space, which, however, may be a non-trivial unitary. The mapping class group action on not on sigma itself, but on the Hilbert space. And this can be quantum universal, already, G, case of the Fibonacci category. Although, because we've doubled, you actually get twice the Fibonacci category. You get an anionic theory. You get an anionic theory, but it's actually twice the Fibonacci category with canceling, with opposite chirality. But in the case of the Fibonacci category, this was the theorem of Friedman-Larsson. And then, so as a quantum code, this has distance. As a quantum code, it's a code with sparse but highly non-additive checks. It can be very far away from an additive code. But still, it's sparse because these bipyramids are local. It may not be all that sparse, but it has bounded density or sparseness. So it has a distance comparable to the minimum cut length of the surface. So the surface, I didn't say so, but it can be open or closed. But you take the shortest curve or line segment where if you cut it, you change the surface. And the distance of one of these systems of projectors as a quantum code is comparable to that. So if you have a fine enough triangulation, then you're in the large distance regime. And in principle, at least, this gives you fault tolerance. Now, I want to, in my remaining minus 5 minutes, address something that John Preskill was talking about at his talk, which is very much to the point. So if you view this not as a software quantum code, but as a model of the physical system, it's fault tolerant in principle, because I think it has an energy gap. I think I have to think about what it means to have an energy gap. The rough idea is if you add up all of these bipyramid projections to make them a Hamiltonian, you really can make a system with an energy gap.
Well, you said they can meet it, so that should be straightforward, right?
Well, right, but it's straightforward if you have good intuition for all the right definitions. So I'll just take your word for it. But I think this is correct. The problem is that just because you have, in physical terms, just because you have an energy gap, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy to stay or reach the minimum energy state, which is when you're in the code. You have defects, and it may be you may have violations of the projection checks, and it may be hard to get rid of them. Okay, so unfortunately, unfortunately, because these are not really the things that you want to compute with, although it could be okay in principle, you want to, if you have a noisy system, these will be, the environment will be creating these, and you just want to keep pushing them back together to get them to annihilate. Okay. Now, as John was explaining, there may not exist, or there does not exist, any purely local fault-tolerant scheme for gathering together the check violations. However, he alluded to a global solution. Okay, so there may not exist purely local ways to cancel them as they are created by error. But, and this is something that should be investigated, I think, especially in the case of the Fibonacci category. There may exist, and I'll just conjecture that it does exist. I'm always a little scared of invoking physics, but I think that this is the correct citation. A postulus thallus type transition. If the controller that's trying to get rid of all of the quasi-particles imposes a long-distance attractive force between them. If the particles are given long-range attraction. So, I don't know exactly how this long-range attraction should decay. The people who study Coskowitz-Thallus transitions would know better than me. But the idea is that you have some decaying attractive force, 1 over r or 1 over r squared or something like that, so that the particles that are created in pairs are gently pushed back together no matter how far apart they are. And then, with a low enough error rate, you expect a transition so that the phase really is corrected. So
this is a finite, you're worried about finite temperature?
Well, see, it's all metaphorical. The main description is that all of this, that whatever your raw qubits look like, you can simulate all of this in software. But I have the feeling that the answer is yes. If this is meant to approximate a real system, so this type of non-local system of doing fault tolerance with local checks is already something that has been analyzed for abelian anemones, which are part of this general scheme, just not for